Yeah, thank you very much, Clint, and good afternoon, everyone. In the next 20 minutes, I want to share some results of us about how we use cryo-electron tomography combined with volume averaging to gain new insights into the exoneme. I will briefly explain the biological background to you, but then most of my talk will deal with the techniques we use and the results we gain with these techniques, and results of our structural comparison of wild-type and mutants. Cilia and flagella are universal motility and sensing organelles in eukaryotes, and they are highly conserved from plants to humans. So, for example, in our human body, we have many cell types which build cilia and flagella, and they are involved in essential functions. And defects in these cilia and flagella are linked to several diseases, for example, infertility or polycystic kidney disease. And what we're trying to do is we want to study, or as the flagellum is highly conserved among species, our approach is we're studying this model organism, Chlamydomonas, this plant, but we hope what we learn about the flagellum in this model organism will also help us to shed some lights on some of the human ciliary diseases. So what you need, please interrupt me at any time if you have questions. And then one thing I should make very clear, I will be dealing with the eukaryotic flagellum. So this morning, Grant was talking about the bacteria flagellum, and the flagellum have the same function. However, their structure is completely different between eukaryotes and bacteria. I want to make that very clear. So what you need to know about the eukaryotic flagellum is Chlamydomonas has two of them. They are surrounded by an outer membrane, and if we remove this outer membrane, we're left with the core structure, the axoneme. And this axoneme contains everything this organelle needs for motion. So you can take this axoneme, so you can detach the flagella from the cell, remove the outer membrane, and as soon as you add ATP, the axoneme alone will beat on its own. So everything essential is in this core structure here. The important thing which I want you to remember is this axoneme consists of 9 microtubule doublets, and all of these microtubule doublets are almost identical. I will explain at the end of my talk what almost means. And all of these doublets consist of one building block, one repeat unit, which is repeated over and over along the length of this flagellum. So here is a longitudinal view showing 3 of these repeat units. So one repeat unit is highlighted here in color. In each of these repeat units, we have about 20 motor proteins, and the motor protein is dynein, which Stan spoke about yesterday. And I am interested in a complex called DRC, the dynein regulatory complex. And what I'm interested in is figuring out how the 10,000 of dynein motors in one flagellum are coordinated and regulated. And it has been previously shown that the DRC is one of the key structures involved in doing this. But essentially nothing is known about the 3D structure. So there's no crystal structure, no nothing what we could use. So we're starting this from scratch. So I guess by now, as we had tomography talks all morning long, I don't think I have to explain this in a lot of detail. Our approach is we use cryo-electron tomography to study the axoneme as close to its natural state as possible. And the workflow is first we record, we put our sample in the microscope, tilt it, record a tilt series, and then in the computer we can use these 2D projections, project them back in one volume exactly under the angles they were taken, and then obtain a three-dimensional structure, the tomograph. And very similar to what Andy showed this morning, here's a very simple explanation what tomography is doing. It is possible to, tomography means you can describe this 2D image by a series of 1D projections. So down here you have a 1D projection of this image. And if you now rotate this image and record all these projections here, you can then in the next step take these projections, project them in the same angles you obtained them into a common volume. And here you see how one projection looks like. It's smeared out over the entire length of the volume. And if you now keep on adding all these projections under the right angle, you will be able to obtain your image again. And this approach does not only work with images of Goethe, it also works with the axoneme. To orientate you, this is the axoneme here, and this is a hole. Here you can see the carbon film. And so this is a short movie on how we obtain our tilt series. And you can see these black dots here are gold fiducials, 10 nanometer gold markers, which we use to align all these projections. And we use the iMod software package to do this. And then in the next, after alignment, we can reconstruct a 3D tomogram from these tilt series. And here you see, similar to a Z-stack you might have done in light microscopy, where we're going through this tomogram layer by layer. Good. So, the iMod software we use is, I guess I can call it, at best, semi-automatic. So the user has to pick these gold fiducials himself. And then the program will basically track these gold markers in all of the images of the tilt series. So what I've shown here is only a small piece of the tilt series. I've only shown two slices, and I've only marked two gold fiducials. You can see one is here in green, one here in red, in two different slices. And this we would use many more of these markers here to align our images, and then reconstruct the tomograms from that, from this. So here is, I guess Andy referred to this as the shitty view. I call it the cross-sectional view of a tomogram. And it doesn't look as bad as you might expect because I'm binning 30 slices here. So, but if you take a close look at two of these doublets here, I hope you can see that we know microtubule doublets have the same density all the way around, but what you can see in the tomogram is you can see the density very well, like on the top, in the middle, and the bottom. But if you look at the side, it seems like there's definitely less density, and it also looks a little extended, a little stretched. And this is the missing wedge problem. This is due to because when we record our samples, we're not sampling the entire 180 degree, but only a smaller fraction of this. So we end up with, the missing wedge is basically a region where we have no data from, and there's nothing what we can do to get this data. So I think the axoneme is actually a great sample for tomography because what we have is we have these 9 microtubule doublets, and each of these microtubule doublets consists of many repeat units. So each of these repeat units itself has at some position the missing wedge. But if we average now all these repeat units from all these 9 microtubule doublets together, we're basically able to obtain information from all possible views. So the combination of all repeat units of all 9 axonemes, by doing this, we're basically able to compensate for the missing wedge. Yes, please. I show you in a second how we do the averaging. Actually, right now. Here's a longitudinal slice of the tomogram. And in red, I have marked 3 of these repeat units. And if I was absolutely right, there's a slightly curvature in here. And what we're doing at this point is we are by hand defining where the center of all these repeat units is. This would be here. Create a model by hand, and then use the program to cut out volumes around this model. And at this point, we take them as they are, never mind how curved they are. But you're absolutely right, this might lead to some problems.
But that is up to along the length. I thought that you were
So we're doing both. So we take all repeat units along one of the doublets, but we're also taking all 9 doublets. So typically within one tomogram, we have something like 200 repeat units. And we always take the same number of all doublets. So this tomographic slice I've shown you here is also binned 15 times. If you look at how the tomogram data looks without any binning, this is what you see. And I guess all of you will agree that this is quite noisy data. The only feature you can see clearly is the microtubule walls. And then if you look very hard, you might be able to see the radial spokes, but that's it. The complex I'm interested in, the DRC, I would not even able to see in these images. So, but what we do now is we start averaging and we combine repeat units. And as I said, not only along one microtubule doublet, we actually do this for all 9 microtubule doublets, and we can also combine several tomograms together. And very important what I should point out, this is done in 3D. So we're cutting out 3D volumes, little subtomograms, and we're averaging the entire 3D volumes. The spinning is just for visualization. If I wouldn't bin it, it would look like this, and you wouldn't be able to see which repeat units I'm talking about. Yeah, when we do the averaging, there's no binning involved. Yeah.
The binning, you mean a projection of 15 slices?
Yes, yeah, it's 15 slices together, taken together, yeah.
Pardon
me?
Is it a square box, right? It's the same dimension?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you could do it with other dimensions, but in our case, we use 100 times 100 times 100 nanometer cubes. So what I show here is only one slice of this tomogram, the one slice in the middle. And if you now start averaging and keep adding more and more subtomograms to this, what you can see is slowly stepwise, you get rid of the noise, and more of the features become visible. Our best quality data set has something like 720 of these subtomograms. For single particle people, this might sound like a joke or something. But as I pointed out, these are 3D volumes. And at this point, we're doing all this more or less manual or at best semi-automatic. But in the future, we will hope by automatization to increase this number by quite a bit. But this is where we are at the moment. So the software program we're using for this 3D averaging is called PEAT. Andy mentioned this this morning already in his talk. PEAT stands for Particle Estimation for Electron Tomography. It's a cross-correlation-based method. It compares a particle. It's called a particle, but it's actually a 3D subvolume. It's comparing a 3D subvolume to a reference, which is also a 3D subvolume. And then alignment is done by shifting around all three axes and also by rotating around all three axes. And the user can specify in which range, with which increment, and how many iterations one would like to do for this averaging. Good. This is how the final average looks like. And you can see in this data now we got rid of a lot of noise. So here we can actually see several features at this signal-to-noise ratio, I'm able to identify my structure, and I'm also able to compare it to other structures. So this is how the isosurface rendering of this structure, of the same volume I just showed you looks like. And the structure in yellow is the dynein regulatory complex I'm interested in. Just to give you an overview on what this looks like. So this is one of these repeat units, and it's 100 nanometers long, to give you an idea about the scale. We're not only doing this with the normal algae, with the wild type, but we're also doing the same approach with several mutants. All these mutants have defects in the dynein regulatory complex. This has been studied before. If you compare, for example, here the wild type to, say, this mutant here, the PF2, you can see there's a dramatic change. So the wild type structure, the yellow structure, is about 1.5 to 2 megadaltons. And we estimate that what's left in this structure here is about 300 kilodaltons. So, there's a severe defect in this structure. But as you can see, if you look at other features around, here you have the radial spokes, some of the dynenes, they look more or less the same. So the defect, this is really not an averaging artifact or so. It's from the mutants. Yes, please. These are mutants in Chlamydomonas, and they're called DRC mutants, which means they have mutations in the dynein regulatory complex. This is known before. And these mutants were isolated. They all swim very, very bad. So it's a very simple screen. You take a bunch of algae, and you screen for the ones which are not able to swim and fall to the bottom. This is how... This could have many reasons, but in this case, it had been verified that the motor domains are okay. The defects are really due to the regulatory domain. I forgot one thing. All these mutants are also characterized biochemically. Biochemically, it's known that the DRC consists of at least 7 components. And we know for all these mutants which of these 7 subunits are present or absent. And in the case of the sub-PF4 mutant, to give an example, we know that subunits 5 and 6 are missing. So if we now compare the two structures and take into account 5 and 6, subunits 5 and 6 are missing, the most simple interpretation of these data would be that units 5 and 6 are located right here where we see the missing structure. And by comparing the wild type to all of these other mutants and also comparing the mutants among each other, we're able to come up with the first very coarse sublocalization of where these different subunits might be located within the structure. This is shown here. So, for example, for DRC subunits 1 and 2, we hypothesize they are located here. For 5 and 6, as I just told you, we think they are here. Another interesting point which came out of this is there was actually quite a bit of electron density which we couldn't coordinate to any of the 7 known components. So this is a strong these are the red densities here. So this is an indication that there are probably more subunits of the DRC which have not yet been characterized. These were very old-fashioned screens. So this is done by random mutagenesis and screening back in the 50s. They were obtained by a screen, random mutagenesis, and then you screen for them. It is not known what the defects are in these mutants. Like, genetically, it's not known what's in them. But biochemically, these mutants have been studied in terms of which of the 7 DRC, which of the known 7 DRC subunits are present or absent. So this is the information we have. But from this, we think that, there are more. Like, the 7 unit is not all of it. It probably consists of more. Sorry, was there another question? I forgot. The biochemistry was done what is actually assembled in the axonemes. In the case of PF2, this is the only mutant which is studied more closely. There's actually only one gene missing. So one gene, and this was attributed to DRC4, I think. So only this one protein is missing, but it affects the assembly of many other subunits. So now in the last few minutes, I'm going to switch gears. So this was basically the easy part. This was the DRC is present in all of these subunits. Yeah.
Before you move on, why is it repeating? Why is this, the DRC complex repeating along the axis?
It's a little bit, I guess, similar to like how proteins are made of. You have one building block, which is basically repeated over and over again, and then you have different modifications. Or it's similar to a microtubule, which also consists of one, or in this case, two units, which are just then polymerized. So you could think of it in a very simple way as a polymer, just how the flagellum is built. So the DRC is present in all of the nine mutants, but just more recently we ran into, when we looked at this image here, we got aware of another interesting issue which fits better to the workshop topic of heterogeneity. So in this image, what you see is actually a slice through the dynein motors, and all these dynein motors here should have exactly the same size, but as you can see, one of them, this one here, looks definitely weaker compared to the other one. So this got us puzzled at first. And then a little later, we were finally able to figure out what's going on. And we're really just at the beginning of this project. It turns out this dynein is only present in some of the nine doublets, not in all of this. This is why in the beginning I said they're almost identical. So there are smaller differences. And this here is one of them. So this dynein is only present in a few of the doublets, not in all of them. And in a very first simple approach, we basically did a manual classification where we looked at in which doublet is it present and not, and classified it. And in the class one, we basically took in all the ones which do not have it. And you see there's almost an empty spot here. And in class two, you see now we have a density here which is as strong as the other ones, what you would expect for a dynein. This one? Oh, this is not a dynein. This is a different complex.
But it correlates. That's what I need to say.
You see? So that could very well be possible because this dynein is actually, or it could be, let's see which one is it. Yeah, it could be somehow connected to these ones. That's possible. Yeah, we haven't looked into that, but that's a very good observation, which I will keep in mind.
Time to finish up.
Yes, I'm actually done. That was it. I'll skip the summary and just jump to my acknowledgement. My mentor and advisor, Daniela, people in my lab, our facility manager. We're very thankful for Nikos' group because we're allowed to use all of his equipment as well, including the computer clusters. And we have two great collaborators, Mary Porter, who has done all the axoneme preps I've told you, and all the software we are using, iMod, SerialEM, PEDE, were all developed in Andy's lab at the 3D lab in Boulder, and David Mastronardi is the main force behind it. Thank you for your attention. No, this is just done by, Oh, I'm sorry. No, please go ahead. I can do it without the computer. Please go ahead. This is just done, if we bin the tomograms a little bit, we can identify where the repeat units are, and then we manually create a model to tell the program where to cut out the volumes.
And then P fine-tunes that for
cross-correlation? We're basically just telling it where to cut out the volumes. And then Pete is doing the comparison to the reference, and there will be shifting, rotation, and all this necessary. It's extracting the SEP volume and then aligning it to the reference.
Stan had a question.
Yes.
It's well known that
Mm-hmm.
So as you go along an accident, the amount of local slider changes. You have a straight accident, no slider, and a bent accident, no slider. So when you combine these different 96 nanometer repeats together,
mm-hmm.
what you actually do, if you're using a curved accident, is combining different conformations of the 96 nanometers.
We don't. But I would be very careful, for example, if the Nexen is stretching or not. I think this is all still under intense debate. And I would guess, so all these dynenes, they have connections to the microtubule as well. So so I would expect this connection is actually, even if they're not bound to the neighboring microtubule, I would expect that they're still somehow... somehow stable enough. I wouldn't expect them to be so flexible, and I would not expect this one dynein to be so flexible and all the others be as stable.